Welcome to Undisclosed, episode 17. We've got three great sponsors for you this week. They include ZipRecruiter, the ABC drama Conviction, and Stamps.com. Make sure you listen in for the spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Until then, enjoy the program.
In the past many weeks, we have gone over how Stanley Sutton, the lead investigator in the murder of Isaac Dawkins, went about very deliberately creating a case against Joey Watkins and Mark Free in the face of totally non-existent evidence, including pressuring their own friends to turn against them. Sutton had another potential source of evidence, though, the jailhouse. Anytime someone is put in jail or prison, it opens up the very dangerous door of other inmates becoming snitches in exchange for something from the authorities. Hi and welcome to this week's Undisclosed, The State versus Joey Watkins. My name is Rabia Chaudhary. I'm an attorney and a fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I'm joined with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
I'm Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney with the Volkov Law Group, and I blog at viewfromll2.com.
I'm Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. In his book, In Cold Blood, Truman Capote notes how the Kansas Bureau of Investigations was coming up empty in its search for the killer of four members of the Clutter family before they caught a break. A jailhouse snitch claimed that his former cellmate, Richard Hitchcock, might have been the murderer, with Perry Smith as his possible accomplice. Capote then sets the scene of lead detective Alan Dewey returning home to find his wife Marie preparing dinner. Without a word, he hands his wife a manila envelope. Capote writes that her hands were wet, she dried them, sat down at the kitchen table, sipped her coffee, and opened the envelope, which had Hitchcock and Smith's mugshots. Meanwhile, Dewey had sent one of his agents, Harold Nye, to Hitchcock's home at night, where he used subterfuge while talking to Hitchcock's parents, leading to them unwittingly corroborating many of the details in the account of the jailhouse snitch. Capote writes that Nye shut his notebook and put his pen in his pocket and both his hands as well, for his hands were shaking with excitement. As Patrick Keefe wrote in the New Yorker article Capote's Co-Conspirators, it's a captivating episode, tense, atmospheric, and grounded in the kind of filmic detail that makes In Cold Blood so memorable. Marie drying her hands, Nye pocketing his. The sequence is also, in most of its particulars, fiction. As the Wall Street Journal revealed last month, a cache of long-lost records from the Kansas Bureau of Investigations depicts a starkly different version of events. Nye did not venture to the farmhouse alone, at night, or under false pretenses. In fact, three members of the KBI made the trip. They did so during the day and spoke only with Hitchcock's mother, and there was no ruse. They told her precisely why they were calling. It's hardly news that In Cold Blood was less immaculately factual than its author liked to boast. Capote's grandiose pronouncements about how he invented a new literary form, the nonfiction novel, amounted to a reckless dare. It's a dare taken by prosecutors every day. It's well established the testimony by jailhouse informants is unreliable, with the Innocence Project reporting that such testimony is one of the leading causes of wrongful convictions nationwide. And yet, in the absence of a more traditional confession, a purported jailhouse confession is one of the few ways that a prosecutor can craft a coherent narrative that will convince the jury of the defendant's guilt. But what happens when such a narrative conflicts with the other evidence, and when it conforms with law enforcement's mistaken beliefs about the crime?
In this case, there are too many jailhouse informants for us to cover them all on the podcast, which is kind of a shame because a lot of the ones we can't cover here have pretty fascinating stories in their own right about how they got involved in the investigation in the first place, or what they claim to have heard, or how the police responded to their stories. But out of the dozens of jailhouse informants, only six made the cut as trial witnesses. We've already discussed two of them, Joey Samples, who was the only jailhouse witness to testify at the trials for both Mark and Joey, and David Jones, the friend of Corey Jacobs that was recorded on The Wire and came up with a story about Mark being passed out in the back seat of Joey's car at the time of the murder. In this episode, we'll discuss three more jailhouse witnesses, one who testified only at Mark's trial, one who recanted before trial, and one who was a last-minute no-show for unexplained reasons.
On August 13th, 2000, Mark was arrested for the third time that year, once again on a probation violation. All of Mark's arrests had been for things like failing to pay a court fine or missing a meeting, the kinds of mistakes you can't make if you're on probation. Then on August 19th, a guy named Todd Beckstein was transferred from Maryland to the Floyd County Jail and became Mark's new cellmate. The following day, on August 20th, Mark confessed to Beckstein about his involvement in Isaac's murder. Or at least that's what Beckstein tells Stanley Sutton 2 days later during his first interview with the Floyd County Police. Beckstein is then interviewed two more times that week, with a tape-recorded interview finally conducted on August 31st.
The first night I was in there, there were some problems concerning Mr. Free and several of the other inmates that were trying to gang up on him. I took Mark Free's side and backed him up so that he wouldn't get beat up, and from that time on, Mark took me into his confidence and proceeded to tell me about a murder that him and a friend, Joey Watson, had committed, and asking me for advice on it.
Okay, now you said Watson. His real name is Joey Watkins.
A couple of the informants gave the same confession backstory, that Mark had been about to get beaten up by some guys who were scarier in the jail, and then after they protected him, he was so grateful he started confiding in them about the murder that he committed. It sounds good in theory, like the way a confession might take place in a movie, but to us it sounds more like proof that these guys barely even knew Mark at all. Because from everything else, from the case file and from what witnesses have said, Mark wasn't one to turn down an offer to fight, and he could more than hold his own. Mark doesn't deny that. When he was told about David Jones and Todd Beckstein's claims about how they befriended him, he laughed. And the cops seemed to have known it was absurd because Mark's reputation for being a willing and ready fighter was part of their usual spiel about Mark and Joey's guilt for Isaac's murder. According to Beckstein, though, the same day he protected Mark from other inmates, Mark told him this.
To my understanding, Joey tried pulling up beside Isaac, and Mark was trying to flag him to pull over, and Isaac wouldn't because Isaac didn't know him. Joey then got close enough and to where Isaac could see it was Joey and got him to pull the car over. And that's when Isaac pulled the car over.
Did they both of them get out of their vehicle, their truck?
What Mark said is Joey got out first, went up to the passenger side, and as he was going up to the passenger side, Mr. Free got out, he went up to the driver's side, Mr. Free walked up on the passenger side. Joey got Isaac's attention by talking to him, and Isaac had the back of his head turned this way, turned to the left so that he could talk to Joey, and that's when Mark shot him. He fired two shots.
But that's not how any of the witnesses to Isaac's wreck saw it happen. Beckstein is saying that Isaac pulled his truck over to speak to Joey through his window, while Mark walked up and shot twice through the passenger side window. But every witness to the wreck saw Isaac's truck cross through the median and then two lanes of traffic before hitting the ditch and flipping over in the woods. Those things seem kind of mutually exclusive with how Beckstein describes the murder, but he found a way to explain it.
They pushed the car off to back on the highway.
They pushed it off with the truck or pushed off with the hands?
They pushed it back onto the highway by hand. Then they got the truck behind it. Mark lined it up. And put the car in drive, and the truck started pushing it, and Mark jumped into the bed of the truck.
I know who was pushing the vehicle, then Isaac's vehicle?
Joey was driving.
Joey was driving, so they pushed Isaac's vehicle while he was in the truck dead or shot?
Yes, sir.
All right, and you said that your boy, Mark Free, jumped in the back bed of the truck?
Yeah, there was no time for him to get in the cab.
All right, so he swayed back and forth, and that's when he wrecked?
Yeah, when he backed off.
Back on the 25th, when we was talking to Jill, you said that they expected the vehicle to do what?
What Mark told me is they were trying to get it going fast enough so that the car would burn up, to burn the body so that they couldn't find out that he was shot, that the body would be burned up.
Unfortunately, Joey and Mark were not successful in pushing the truck fast enough to make it burn up and hide all the evidence of the crime. According to Beckstein, Mark and Joey then drove a bit down the highway before turning around and driving back to where Isaac crashed. Joey got out of the truck and checked on Isaac, and when Joey saw that he was dead, he freaked out and ran back to the truck with Mark. Then they sped off and went to switch the white truck they'd borrowed from the car lot to commit the crime, so that Joey could show up at Aslan's house in a different white truck from the one the crime had been committed in.
But surely Sutton wouldn't take Beckstein at his word, right? A story like that ought to have some form of corroboration, and Sutton claimed he had done just that, that he was able to investigate and corroborate Beckstein's story by saying he spoke to Ricky Bray, the tow truck driver who towed Isaac's truck after the wreck. As Sutton would later write in an affidavit,
after concluding the interview with Todd Beckstein, Investigator Sutton realized that for Isaac Dawkins' vehicle to be pushed, the vehicle would have to be in neutral, On August 25th, 2000, Investigator Sutton contacted Ricky Bray of Rabbits Wrecker Service. Ricky Bray told Investigator Sutton that Isaac Dawkins' vehicle was in neutral when he began the towing process.
There were two huge problems with this story, though. The first of these is that Ricky Bray was not the correct wrecker to speak to. Ricky Bray was the wrecker who towed Isaac's truck into the Rome Police Department's parking deck, but he was not the original wrecker on the scene. That was Terry Ferguson, who you heard back in episode 4 of the podcast. Terry Ferguson is the one who towed the truck from the scene, but his wrecker was too big to put the truck in the parking deck, and that's where Bray came in.
Because someone, one of them, I think it was Marshall Smith, somebody followed us over to the police station. Because once I got there and unloaded it, me and Ricky Bray hooked to it, and we had to really drug it into the basement. And they told us where to put it at. And then we covered the truck up. And now 2 days later, I think it might have been 2 days later, Ricky Bray went back over there and got the truck and carried it to his storage lot.
And yes, the truck likely was in neutral and Ricky Bray saw it, but that's only because Terry would have put it in neutral to tow it in the first place. The second problem is that if the truck had been in neutral, that would have contradicted Beckstein's story and not confirmed it. That's because Beckstein told Sutton that Mark had described to him how he put the truck in drive before pushing it off the roadway.
Mark turned around, put the car in drive, and they pushed it with the truck. Mark jumped in the back of the truck. He said once the car was going so fast, it started weaving in front of them. They couldn't keep the truck lined up, and the car went off the road and crashed into a tree.
Hey there, Undisclosed Listener. Are you an employer? And if so, are you hiring? And if so, do you know where to post that job so you find the best candidate? If you think you found that one site that's going to get you that best hire and it seems so perfect, it probably isn't. That's because you need to post on hundreds of job sites and social media networks to get the best possible hire. Posting your job in just one place isn't enough. If you want to find the perfect hire, you're going to have to hit all those sites up. And guess what? Now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to over 100 job websites, including social media sites like Twitter and Facebook, all with a simple click of your mouse. You can find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post your job once and watch the candidates roll in using ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or phone calls in your office. You can quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. So find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 1 million businesses. And right now, listeners of Undisclosed can post jobs to ZipRecruiter for free. All you gotta do is go to ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. That's ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. One more time, ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed.
And then there's another little detail uncovered by Claire when she got Sutton's notes. Something that, to me, calls into question whether Beckstein had been a plant from the very beginning. And that's the fact that on August 21st, Sutton's notes have a small notation. August 21, 2000. Sutton talked with Ricky Bray at Rabbit's Towing. But August 21st is one day before Sutton is supposed to have learned of Beckstein's existence. On August 22nd, that's when Sutton goes to talk to Beckstein, and he gets the whole push the truck into a tree to make it explode story. So why would Sutton have been interviewing Ricky Bray on the 21st? That would only make sense if Sutton had already known what Beckstein was going to say ahead of time. But combined with the other oddities with Beckstein's story and background, Claire and I have both wondered the same thing. Was Todd Beckstein deliberately planted in Mark's cell to be a snitch? We have no way to prove it, but it makes more sense than any other theory we can come up with. And the GBI had used Beckstein as a snitch before, something Sutton would later discuss with a GBI agent and include in his wiretap affidavit.
But all of these 1001 problems with Beckstein's story are kind of beside the point. No matter how many extra errors Beckstein added in, the basic premise of the story is so ridiculous that Sutton had to know it was a lie. And at the preliminary hearing, the defense tried to take this tactic in cross-examining Sutton. Sutton, however, refused to give in and continued to defend Beckstein's story. Here's the exchange from the preliminary hearing.
Question. Well, my question is, it doesn't fit the evidence, does it? Answer, I'm just telling you what he gave. Mark Free told him that, so I'm just relaying what he said. Question, I understand, and I'm asking you as an investigator. I say, it doesn't fit your evidence, does it? Answer, well, it's possible, it's very possible, anything is possible. It could have happened that way.
Although Sutton went back and interviewed Beckstein 6 or 7 times about what Mark had been telling him while they were locked up together, Mark eventually got released from jail on October 5th, which meant Beckstein could no longer inform the police about what Mark had been saying. Or, well, it would have meant that. But Sutton thought Beckstein was so important that, despite him having a pending charge for felony escape, for walking out of a detention center where he was being held on a previous charge and then leaving the state, Sutton was able to pull some strings and get Beckstein released.
Have you been promised anything in order to come in and testify?
No, sir. The only thing that was talked about was after several conversations with Detective Stanley Sutton. He said he would maybe try to get me out of the jail, which he did. But this was after we'd already talked numerous times.
And you already made the statement?
Yes, sir.
But, as Beckstein assured the jury at Mark's trial, him getting released from jail on his felony charge wasn't what had motivated him to come forward.
Had that influenced you in coming forward?
No, sir.
Why did you come forward?
Sir, I've done some wrong things in my life. But, I've never hurt nobody in what I've done. And the way that Mark bragged about the way Isaac looked, the way his head snapped when the bullet hit him, the way he looked when he went up and checked the body. He was actually proud of it. It turned my stomach to the point that I did something I'd never done before in my life, and I turned informant because it was that grotesque.
Which isn't true, by the way. Beckstein had a documented history in Georgia of being a jailhouse informant. But once Beckstein was back on the street, the Floyd County Police Department booked a hotel for him and got him set up with a wire so he could go record a conversation with Mark in the hopes that Mark would say something incriminating to his buddy from jail. But the wire, well, it didn't go very well for the cops.
When Beckstein showed up at Mark's house and knocked on the door, Mark apologized to him and said, "Sorry, man, can't talk now." Mark said his attorney had told him to stay away from everyone he'd been with in jail because they were getting questioned by the cops. And Beckstein told him that was bullshit. If he'd been a snitch, wouldn't the police have arrested him already? But Mark told Todd, it's nothing personal. He's just doing what his lawyer said to do. Sorry. And that was the end of that.
So after a couple of minutes of being shut down by Mark, Beckstein got back in the taxi and returned to the hotel where the police were waiting.
In that time, they had got another inmate from the jail to come to my house. Like I said, in the taxi cab. And had him roomed up at the Days Inn, and come to find out he was wired. And I got statements on it too.
That's Beckstein.
Todd Beckstein. Beckstein.
Yeah. The fake spy stuff cracks me up.
Yeah, like, showing up
in a taxi. Hey man, what's up? Hey, you know where I live? Oh man, you told me before. No, I don't think so.
Was he acting weird?
They were just trying to act all friendly, like, I'm your best friend, help me out. You know, I'm like, and he started questioning about me immediately. I think after 30 seconds, he's asking me about the murder. And I said, I can't talk to you about that. My lawyer said, not talk to nobody. You gotta leave. So he gets in the taxi and leaves.
I can't believe they sent him to your house in a taxi cab.
That was surreal.
He should have at least, like, come walking up the road.
Right? Let him out down the street. Say, hey, man, I was in the neighborhood, man. I thought I'd try to find you or hit you up or something.
Of course, your first thought is going to be, this man has a wire on him and he's trying to get some dirt on me. You're just like, what is with that dude?
Yeah. And I know you from jail. We ain't best friends. We're not brothers. Sorry. It don't happen like that.
Yeah. Get back in your cab and go away.
That's it.
While we have no records of it, it seems like the Floyd County Police freed a few other of Mark's cellmates to do exactly the same thing. If so, we have no copies of the tapes made, but Beckstein's wire mentions two others that got released when he did.
During the wire, when Beckstein goes to Mark's house to talk to him and try and get him to say something incriminating, they mentioned other guys they were in jail with. In particular, they mentioned guys named Ricky and Gene. And Todd Beckstein says, yeah, we all got out the same day.
Yeah, and what Beckstein said in The Wire matches perfectly with Sutton's notes. On October 14th, Sutton's notes read, quote, Investigator Sutton had to babysit with Todd Beckstein. And, quote, Gene S. getting out of jail stated he knew Mark Free and would help us. And scrawled above that is another name, Ricky H. So the three mentioned on The Wire, the three who were housed closest to Mark at the jail, were all mysteriously released from jail on the exact same day and then mysteriously showed up asking Mark and Joey a lot of questions. Those three, though, were far from the only people at the jail questioned. On October 10th, 5 days after Mark got released on his probation violation, Sutton's notes read, quote, interviewed 32 inmates at jail in reference to Mark Free. As you can probably tell, then, when it comes to investigating Joey and Mark, Sutton would spare no expense and leave no stone unturned.
Todd Beckstein did testify at Mark's trial, although notably, Fred Simpson, the prosecutor, only had Beckstein tell the part of the story that involved Mark shooting Isaac. He left out the part about pushing Isaac's truck across a road so it would wreck into a tree. Right after Beckstein testified about the shooting, Prosecutor Simpson changes the subject to something else and smoothly admits the whole pushing the truck to make it explode thing. That part did come up briefly on cross-examination, but the sheer insanity of Beckstein's whole story is still oddly understated. At Joey's trial, though, there was barely any mention of Beckstein. Actually, Joey's defense was prohibited from bringing it up.
Question. Mr. Shiflett, now, when you were corroborating what Mr. Beckstein said, you know what he said, don't you? What Mr. Beckstein's story was? Answer. Yes, sir. Some of it, yes, sir. Question. He said that... Colston. I'm going to object to this, Your Honor. The court. No, we're not going to get into... Colston. Your Honor, first of all, it's irrelevant because this is testimony against Mark Free, the co-defendant. He was the one that was in jail with him. Second of all, it's total hearsay. Mr. Beckstein, since he's not a witness in this case, it's totally irrelevant and hearsay.
But the real importance of Beckstein's story, at least in October of 2000, wasn't so much his use as a trial witness. It was his use as a witness that could support a wiretap order. With all other leads coming up empty, Sutton decided the best way to get proof of Joey and Mark's guilt was to get a wiretap on their phone lines. And so Sutton decided Beckstein could serve as a probable cause that was necessary for a wiretap warrant to get obtained. In an affidavit under penalty of perjury, Sutton told the court that, during his interviews with Beckstein at the end of August, Beckstein had told Sutton about numerous calls he'd witnessed Mark making to his friend David Brown. And Beckstein said David would then call Joey so all three of them could talk on a three-way call. Sutton had followed up by pulling toll records of all calls made from the jail payphones during the time period that Mark was locked up, and also the toll records for David and Joey's homes. Sutton described the results in his affidavit stating,
Bell South subscriber information indicates that 15 calls were made from one of the four payphones located in G Block at the Floyd County Jail to the residence of David Brown. In addition, Bell South subscriber information indicates that three calls from the payphones of G Block at the Floyd County Jail were made to the residence of Joey Watkins.
That proves Beckstein's story, right? Well, no, not at all. In fact, it seems like pretty strong proof that Sutton knowingly lied in his affidavit, because Sutton knew from those records, or should have known, that everything Beckstein told him was a lie.
Also, when I first interviewed you on the 22nd, you had mentioned that Mark calls Joey, that Mark Free calls Joey Watkins at the jail.
Yes, sir.
He
called Joey to jail. Mark's the one in jail. He calls Joey at home.
That Mark is in jail and he calls Joey at home.
Yes, sir.
How does he call him?
Through three ways, through David.
He told you that?
Yeah. I was by the phone when he did it one night. Yes.
You was by the phone when he called David's house through three way and got Joey?
Yes, sir, because David also made a three way call for me first.
But between August 19th and August 22nd, there are no phone calls from any jail payphones to either Joey Watkins or David Brown. Zip. Nada. And the rest of the calls that Beckstein talks about, the ones he told Sutton happened after the 22nd, all the ones Mark was supposedly making during this time period, well, from the phone records, none of them could have happened either. For instance, only three calls from jail payphones were made to Joey's phone number, and all of them were made on September 18th, 2000, long after Beckstein's statement to the police. And out of the 14 calls from jail payphones that were made to David's phone in that time period, none of them match a time when a three-way call could have been made to Joey's line. So these three-way conversations that Bechstein describes, Bechstein couldn't have witnessed them.
Now, the court found Sutton's affidavit to be sufficient, and so a warrant was issued for a wiretap on Joey's house. For 19 days, teams of officers from the Rome and Floyd County Police Departments, and also apparently an FBI agent, would sit and monitor Joey's phone line. And for 19 days, they would hear nothing that supported Joey's or Mark's guilt in Isaac's murder. And that's not because Joey and Mark were too clever to use the phone to discuss sensitive matters, because they weren't. Despite acknowledging at one point that their attorneys and others had warned them not to discuss the case over the phone, they promptly ignored that warning and spoke to each other on the phone dozens of times discussing the police investigation and how the cops were trying to build a case against them. We don't have copies of the tapes. Floyd County says it can't provide those to Joey's attorney, so all we've got are the listening post logs and Colston's return on the wiretap. From what we know, 1,257 calls were intercepted, of which 50 were classified as evidence calls, that is, calls, quote, related to the conspiracy alleged in the investigative warrant and attached affidavit involving violations of Georgia's murder statute. In the return, someone has listed 22 of those calls with a brief discussion of those contents. Then, in the margin, someone has gone down and given an assessment of how useful each call is to the case.
And in every case, the verdict was the same. The notations read, not helpful, not helpful, not helpful, nothing, not helpful, not helpful, not very helpful. This is despite the fact that many of those calls are, from the description, calls that you would expect to be a prosecutor's goldmine. Like, call 56. Joey and Mark about being suspects and the interview of Mark by Sutton and Shiflett. Or call 659. Mark, Joey, and Tim talking about Todd Bechstein being a snitch. Or call 563. With Joey asking Mark about what he'd said to their attorney. Or call 610. Mark Free talking to Joey about case. And despite having been warned throughout the investigation about the possibility of a wiretap, Mark and Joey were discussing things one probably wouldn't be discussing if they actually thought there was a wiretap on the phone. Like about how Mark was going to hook up a friend for a pot sale, or Joey making threats to kill Stanley Sutton. The latter, by the way, were presumably not serious threats. From context, or as much context as can be seen from the return, they were of the loudmouth, trash-talking, non-serious variety, not actual death threats. The notes say, for instance, Joey telling his dad that he is sick of Stanley Sutton, dash, threatening Sutton, dash, dad hangs up on Joey. And a little later, after Joey learns of Sutton questioning Kelly, a call about, quote, Joey telling mom that Sutton has fucked with him for the last time, dash, ready to kill him. It seems possible, though, that this final description of the call was designed to make it seem more serious than it was in reality, because an earlier brief description of the contents of the call describes the call as, instead, quote, not going to put Kelly through it. Joey makes somewhat of a threat about Stanley. And that's followed by three question marks. So, 19 days with at least two law enforcement officers on the wiretap 24/7, and the best they got was Joey making somewhat of a threat about Stanley Sutton, and him complaining about how Sutton was ruining his life. That is a massive amount of resources for Rome and Floyd to have spent on a single case just to come up empty. I wish we could hear those calls, though. No, they likely would not have been admissible as evidence, so it wouldn't have made a difference at trial. But how often do you get to listen in on a private conversation between two co-defendants as they discuss the murder they're accused of? Because while we don't know exactly what Mark and Joey said to one another, we know that nothing they said indicated they were guilty. So the police must have convinced themselves that Joey and Mark were putting on a show for their benefit, both of them feigning innocence to one another despite both knowing they were guilty. Which is kind of a hilarious idea to me, because I know this isn't an objective assessment, it's more dairy cow eyes kind of stuff, but I just don't see them being capable of that kind of subtlety. Mark is a blunt, no-nonsense kind of guy, and Joey has no discernible filter. For them to improv a 22-minute conversation about the case in which they pretended innocence, I mean, they could have done it, I guess. Maybe. But you'd think that hearing that performance would have at least caused investigators to second-guess themselves, at least a little. but it didn't. It just made them look for alternative ways of building their case, like finding more snitches.
I know that undisclosed listeners are crime buffs, and I don't just mean crime buffs in general, but I mean the kind of people who are deeply invested and interested in issues of criminal injustice. Many of you follow other podcasts and watch documentaries and films made about true crime stories, but when you want to take a little bit of downtime, I have a recommendation for you, and that is a new crime drama that's airing on Mondays at 10, 9 central on ABC. It's called Conviction. And what makes this show different is that while most crime stories end behind bars, that's where Conviction starts. Because every year, over 10,000 people in America are wrongfully convicted. The show is inspired by real-life conviction integrity units that are popping up across the country. And the purpose of these units is to review potentially wrongful verdicts, investigate, and then recommend that the sentence either be overturned or let it stand. In this high-paced drama, the CIU team only has 5 days per case. The team's made up of lawyers, a former detective, forensic experts, and they're led by Hayes Morrison, who's the daughter of an ex-president and a reformed party girl, and she now stands as a defender for the unjustly prosecuted. And she's not only known for her feisty and no-holds-barred attitude, but also her willingness to question every part of the judicial system, kind of like our very own Susan Simpson. So this week's Torn from the Headlines case is about a protest march that was shattered by violence, leaving a police officer dead from a bullet wound, and one radical activist sentenced to life in prison. 6 years later, the case is being reopened when Hayes Morrison and her team discover evidence of jury tampering, racial bias, and a cover-up that will leave you speechless. It's a case as controversial as our times, and an episode that will have you guessing and second-guessing right up to the very last minute. From the executive producer of Criminal Minds, Conviction airs Mondays, 10, 9 central, after Dancing with the Stars on ABC. While the vast majority of snitches in the case claimed it had been Mark they'd heard confessing, there were also two that claimed Joey had confided in them when he was jailed following his arrest for murder: Winfred Reese Ellis and James Paul Cooley. Both were supposed to testify at Joey's trial, but a monkey wrench was thrown in the prosecution's case when, right before Joey's trial, Reese Ellis changed his mind. "Joey didn't confess to me," he said. "I made that whole thing up. I just wanted to see if you guys would give me a better deal." But Tammy Colston assured the jury there was no reason to disbelieve what he'd said before. Ellis was telling the truth when he said Joey confessed to him, and another jailhouse informant can verify it. In her opening arguments, Colston said,
"Winfred Reese Ellis, you are going to meet him. He is an inmate at the Floyd County Jail, and James Paul Cooley, he is an inmate at the Floyd County Jail. There were reward posters put up. They were put up at the jail. That was to get people to come forward if they knew anything. And also, you have got people that are going to say, well, I told the truth, I didn't tell the truth, I didn't. Winfred Ellis is one. He gave the police a statement that he was in the cell with Joey Watkins, and Joey Watkins told him about this crime. He gave several details. Y'all will get to hear it firsthand, live and in Technicolor. And then James Paul Cooley will come in and say, he still says it's the truth. He hasn't been tried yet. I don't know what to tell you, but the devil is in the details again."
The first statement, though, from January 23rd, 2001, was a big old nothing burger.
"Just like I said, I wrote Jeff a letter that said that I had some information about the Free case, Free and Watkins case, and that I'd like to talk with Stanley Sutton about it. The only reason I knew he was the detective on it is because I've heard Joe talk so much about it."
Okay. What has Joey Watkins told you about this murder?
Just that time he said if they wouldn't have done it, they wouldn't be in this mess. Other than that, I've heard him tell all kinds of stories as to how it could have happened or who might have done it or somebody else had a motive to do it. But
when he said, if we hadn't have done this, it wouldn't be in this mess, what was your first response to him?
I didn't say anything to him. I was like this. And then that was basically the end of it. I went back out there and started playing cards again. But it's just evident the way he acts. They're guilty anyhow, you know. He just thinks he's going to get out of it.
Ellis had no details, no corroboration, just a story about Joey saying once, "Well, gee, if we hadn't done it, we wouldn't be in this mess now." 2 weeks later, though, Ellis wrote to the police again saying that this time he had a much better story to offer.
Yeah, so we don't have the audio from Ellis' statement, but here's a portion of it. Well, it started the other day. I'm not sure of the exact day. It was a couple of days ago when he come to my room and he was happy. He was kind of laughing. He was telling me they was out diving in Swan Lake all day, you know, dragging the lake and diving the lake. And his comment to that was, "It's in a lake, but it's not that lake." And then yesterday when I after I wrote the letter, after I talked with him, he said his girlfriend's left him, so he kind of had a bleeding heart, I guess. And we was playing cards and talking, and I'd kind of told him a little about my situation. He was telling me about, you know, Isaac Dawkins and him and Mark, and he said that they'd seen him at a gas station, and they turned around and they chased him down. And when they were out of view of any cars, he said, as they were coming around, that Mark just pow.
Swan Lake is a lake beside where Mark's family lived, up north of Rome. In early February, a few days before Ellis' second interview, the lake had been searched after someone made an anonymous call to Tammy Colston and said that the gun used to kill Isaac had been tossed there. The search wasn't successful, however, and it's possible the police were feeling an itty bit sensitive about how it had gone.
And then a new snitch, this one from Joey, says, "Oh yeah, Joey was laughing at that because he threw the gun in the lake, but not that lake."
Yeah, okay, I remember that now. Matter of fact, one of the detectives dropped their gun in the lake, searching for the gun. So.
Oh, like unintentionally?
Yeah. Had to go get it, recover it. It's like, I don't know, this sudden, no, they remind me of Three Stooges or something. Picture them trying to run through the door at the same time, or just, I don't know.
And then, despite Ellis' new and improved and court-usable statement, Ellis backed out. He recanted. In May, he was convicted on his pending rape charge and sentenced to 10 years in prison, and he changed his mind about testifying against Joey, said that he made it all up. And in June, a couple of weeks before Joey's trial, he was interviewed by a defense attorney, and Ellis tells him it had all been lies.
He made a comment, "It's in a lake, but it's not that lake." Did he ever make that statement to you?
All lies.
He also told you that he and Mark Free chased down Isaac Dawkins and that Mark shot him and gave you some particulars concerning that and admitting his guilt. Did he ever say those things to you?
No, sir.
How did you know about all these particulars?
I read the transcripts from his preliminary hearing.
You had access to the preliminary hearing transcript?
Yes, sir. Uh-huh.
In his second statement, the one where he had actually known a couple basic facts about the case, that was because he'd been able to read the transcripts from Joey's preliminary hearing. Kind of a crazy story. When Joey had been in the shower, leaving his things unguarded, Ellis had been able to take the transcripts and read them. And so that's how he learned some of these basic facts about the case. Now, according to Ellis, he hadn't been promised anything in exchange for his testimony. The cops weren't lying about that. They'd just done him a few favors here and there.
Now, prior to your being interviewed, were you given any promises or anything?
No, I wasn't promised anything.
Were you given any type of special treatment?
Just the one time when he came to talk to me and took me, like I was telling you about, I put a ride.
Took you where?
Took me to Wendy's, had me a pack of cigarettes waiting in the car.
Were you cuffed during this visit?
No, sir.
So you just went on a joyride to a fast food place?
Around.
Okay. Why did you tell Stanley Sutton and Bill Shiflett these things?
I guess because I wanted to see about getting a deal and getting out.
So, aside from the frosty here and there and the occasional packs of cigarettes, he hadn't been given anything directly. The cops had told him they couldn't make him any promises, they'd just see what they could do. And then after he was sentenced, he'd said he'd made it all up, he wasn't going to testify against Joey anymore. Now, despite having recanted, Reese Ellis actually testified at Joey's trial. Prosecutor Tammy Colston warned jurors that he was going to lie and played a recording of his prior statement, insisting that was the truth, and it had been entirely predictable that he'd lie in the stand.
I knew Reese Ellis was going to lie. He had already given a statement to the defense that he was, oh, I lied to the police back then. He had already told them.
But, she said, pay careful attention to the things he said before. Their proof that Joey really did confess to him, it's just that once he learned the prosecutor's office wasn't going to give him a deal after all, he felt bad about snitching on Joey. After Ellis testified, Colston then played the tape of Ellis' second statement. That, she said, was the truth, and his testimony under oath was a lie, and we know this because of the details of what Ellis said. For instance, Ellis had known that Josh Flemister, Joey's friend who had confessed to the police, hadn't been with Joey when the shooting happened. But since Sutton had claimed in the preliminary hearing transcript that Josh's confession wasn't false, how could Ellis have known otherwise? In other words, we know Joey confessed to Ellis because Josh Flemister had only been able to falsely confess based upon the details that Joey gave him, and Reese Ellis had only been able to know that Josh's confession had been false because of the details Joey gave him. And then Colston argued there were all those details that Ellis hadn't known, details that would have made his story really convincing if it had been false. She asked Ellis, for instance,
okay, if you would have remembered what was in the preliminary hearing, and there was testimony that a woman had heard two shots fired, would that not have been an important fact to tell the officers?
In fact, at one point, Colston even tried to call into question Ellis' testimony by suggesting that, if he were relying upon the preliminary hearing transcript, his story would have sounded more ridiculous. Well, she asked, do you remember anything in the preliminary hearing about, like, pushing a truck? And Ellis said yes, or maybe the detectives told him about it. So Colston quizzed him on why he didn't use that story instead. He'd made the whole thing up, why'd he tell them about the shooting happening after a chase instead of telling them about the pushing story? And Ellis told her that, well, because it didn't sound as good as the one about them driving up beside them.
And then there's James Paul Cooley. On February 6th, 3 days after Ellis gave his second statement to the police, another guy from Joey's cell block came forward. James Paul Cooley told the Floyd County police officers that Joey had confessed to him too, and that actually he'd happened to overhear Joey confessing to Ellis as well and could corroborate Ellis' story.
What made him confide in you and tell you this?
I really don't know. He had told another person that was in a cell next to him about it, and I heard him talking about it.
You know who that person was?
Winfred Ellis.
Okay.
And
could you hear them talking about it with each other?
I could hear them through the vent, because my room's right next to Joe's, and I could hear them through the vent.
Okay.
And I walked over and talked to him about them, you know, searching the lake, and just told him, I said, yeah, I know it's in Lake Wise. I heard you saying it was in Lake Wise. And he just opened up and started telling me.
Cooley says that basically once he confronted Joey with the knowledge that he'd overheard him telling Ellis about tossing the gun in Lake Weiss, Joey had decided he might as well confess everything else to Cooley as well. But there's one problem with Cooley's story. Okay, well, there's a lot of problems, but even from the beginning, there's one huge one. Cooley claims to have confronted Joey about him confessing to Ellis that he tossed the gun in Lake Weiss, but Ellis never said that Joey told him that. In fact, Ellis told the police just the opposite, that Joey had never mentioned anything about what lake it might have been in, just that it was in the lake, but not Swan Lake. Ellis did say that he'd learned from another guy in jail that Joey had been to Lake Weiss the day after the murder, but he never heard a word about it from Joey himself. Cooley's apparent ability to verify Ellis' story was no accident, though. In fact, according to Ellis, that had been the plan from the beginning.
So, you know, coming up with this idea that, you know, they kept bugging me about it, asking me what did I know. I kept telling them I didn't know nothing. Talked about Paul Cooley and a couple other guys. And I kept telling them that, you know, because me and Joey was together all the time. We just hung out together. We didn't mess with nobody else, really. And they kept telling me that I knew something. I kept telling them I didn't.
They being Paul?
Yeah, Paul.
Was his attorney with him?
No, I'm just talking about when we was in the box. And he told, you know, he came up with this idea because they know I'd read the preliminary hearings. But Joey didn't let nobody else read it, just me. And come up with a thing that, you know, would come up with a story. And the deal was that when I told them the story, that then they would get, Paul Cooley would verify it, because he knew exactly what I was going to tell them. And he was going to go to Stanley Sutton Inn and tell them that he had overheard Watkins tell me this stuff.
Okay. So then he was going to kind of back up what was being said to you.
Yeah.
And this was Cooley's idea?
Yeah, and from what I understand, he did that. Told him that he had heard me.
Did he tell you that?
No, because I got moved out of P Block not long after that.
So you don't know as a fact if you actually talked to the police or not?
Well, Stanley said to me.
Also, Stanley told you that Cooley talked to
him. Told me that he had talked to somebody else that verified my story.
So, according to Ellis, Cooley's statement, like his own, was derived from the transcripts of Joey's pre-trial hearings, and the story Cooley gives backs that up. Like Tammy Colston says, the devil is in the details. And so many of the details Cooley knows have Stanley Sutton as their only source.
They took Joe's truck, went to the car lot, picked up a car, which he'd had the keys to, he got earlier that day, dropped his truck off there, and they were going to out to Floyd College, I guess it is, and going to follow him home. They were running behind, and they saw him at the BP station right past Floyd College. Mm-hmm. So they pulled in there, followed him out of there, followed him down 27 till there was no cars in sight. And said as they were going around passing him, they shot at him twice.
What Cooley said about running into Isaac at the BP station, well, that's not something any other witness had said before. The only other time it has ever been suggested that Joey encountered Isaac at the BP is, you guessed it, by Stanley Sutton at the preliminary hearing.
Yeah, so according to Sutton at the preliminary hearing, quote, on the next time we interviewed him, we had learned in talking with two individuals that Josh Flemister had confided to them about his role or his involvement of the killing of Isaac Dawkins with Joey Watkins. After doing a taped interview with these two ladies, we in turn interviewed Josh Flemister on November the 11th. His statement was that he was with Joey Watkins and he was with Mark Free the night of January the 11th, and they were looking for Isaac Dawkins. They saw Isaac Dawkins on 27 South near the BP service station and the Golden Gallon. They turned around on him and proceeded to catch up with him.
But what Josh had actually told the police was that they'd encountered Isaac at the store next to the Hardee's, directly across from Floyd College. The BP is north of Floyd College on the same side of the highway, and Sutton misspoke in his testimony when he said that Josh had identified the BP as a spot where they encountered Isaac. And yet, Paul Cooley managed to include this inaccurate detail in his statement, which gives us two options. Either Sutton had incorrectly said BP when he testified at the preliminary hearing, but just so happened to be coincidentally right, and Joey later confessed to Paul Cooley this detail, or else Paul Cooley had gotten that detail from the preliminary hearing transcript and had then parroted that detail back to Sutton. I'm going with the latter, because that wasn't the only misstatement from Sutton's preliminary hearing testimony that found its way into both Cooley's and Ellis's statements. For instance, both Cooley and Ellis make a similar claim that no other witness ever mentions.
Followed him down 27 till there was no cars in sight, and said as they were going around passing him, they shot at him twice.
And from Ellis's second statement,
they turned around and they chased him down, and when they were out of view of any cars, he said as they were coming around him that Mark just pow.
But this thing about being out of sight of any cars, it isn't true. There were at least three witnesses in southbound cars at the time of the shooting, and more importantly, the only real eyewitness, Wayne Benson, who testified that he saw the moment Isaac's truck left the road. And there's no reason for Joey to have confessed to waiting until they were out of view before doing the shooting, because that's not what the shooter did. But it is what Sutton said at the preliminary hearing. Quote,
well, to my understanding, listening to Moser and talking with the other investigators, they had passed and the red light caught him at Walker Mountain in 27 South. And the vehicles in question was at a high rate of speed and beyond his eyesight until he came over the rise, and then he seen Isaac's truck over in the wooded area.
Sutton got it wrong. Benson was in sight when the truck left the road, and Sutton's mistake is mysteriously repeated back by two jailhouse informants with access to the transcript of the hearing where Sutton made the error. And there are other errors in Cooley's story, too, ones that couldn't have come from Joey directly.
Paul, I appreciate you talking to me. I'm going to turn the tape recorder off now. The time is about 1:45 p.m. Okay, the tape recorder's back on. It's about 1:46. Paul, if you will, tell me about a conversation you had with Joey Watkins about Isaac and a female friend of his.
Yeah, he said that Isaac came over to his house one night because Joe had been calling Breanne, I don't know her last name, had been calling her and giving her a hard time because she was seeing Isaac and not Joe. She broke up with Joe or whatnot. And Isaac came over and told him to stop calling, you know, stop harassing and threatening him. And Joe threatened to, you know, beat him up or whatever. And Isaac spit in Joe's face. And then they got in a fight and Joe lost. And it hurt his pride because he's a Watkins. And that was the reason he went back after him to shoot him. And he said he thought it was 6 months was plenty of time where the finger wouldn't be pointed at him.
So he said he waited that long so that the finger wouldn't be pointed at him.
Cooley's claim should have made the police drop him as a witness immediately. Because Cooley's story about why Joey shot Isaac isn't true, can't be true, and isn't something Joey ever would have confessed to. The night Isaac came to Joey's house had nothing to do with Joey calling Breanne. It was because Isaac and Joey had words while they were out cruising in town. And Joey and Isaac hadn't even fought. Isaac had refused to get out of the car, and it ended there. But if Joey was the kind of guy to be so enraged by losing a fight that he'd spend 6 months plotting a murder to reclaim his damaged pride, why would he have lied to Cooley about losing a fight that never even happened? But what's interesting in the story is that it could not have come from the preliminary transcript either, which means the cops had to have been giving Cooley at least some of the information themselves, which he would then repeat back to them.
So if you're anything like me, thinking about the upcoming holiday season brings a lot of joy, but also a lot of dread. Why the dread? Well, it's because I've got visions of standing in long lines at the post office dancing in my head. Imagine yourself standing in line at the post office, stacks of boxes in your hand, trying to fill out all those labels, stuffed in between people with big coats and runny noses. Now let that horrible vision dissipate as you instead see yourself sitting at home, feet up on your desk, sipping on a warm cup of hot cocoa, as your printer prints out all of the labels that you need to send out the gifts to your loved ones. With Stamps.com, you can avoid all the hassle that comes with trying to mail the dozens of packages and letters you're going to send to friends and relatives all across the country by avoiding the post office altogether this busy holiday season. Everything you would do at the post office, you can instead do right from your desk. So right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code UNDISCLOSED. You're going to get a special offer that will include a 4-week trial, plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top right of the page and enter our promo code UNDISCLOSED. That's Stamps.com. Enter UNDISCLOSED.
Ultimately, the jury didn't hear from Cooley at trial, although they heard about what he would have said if he had testified. Colson told the jury during opening arguments that she would be calling Cooley after Ellis to have Cooley verify Ellis' story. She also convinced the court to let her introduce the dead dog issue on the basis that she'd call Cooley later to link it all up, to connect Joey to the dog's death. And then, just before Reese Ellis testified, she told the court again she'd be calling Cooley after Ellis. But she didn't.
And I can't help but wonder if it's because of an exchange that occurred at the very end of Ellis' testimony, during cross-examination by defense attorney Bill O'Dell. O'Dell asked, "Do you have any personal knowledge of Paul Cooley snitching on anybody else, not just..." And then Colson objects. O'Dell says, "Okay, fine. We're going to hear from Cooley. I'll get it from Cooley himself." And they move on. Ellis' examination ends, and supposedly, Cooley is going to be called next. But Colson says, "Oh, I'm going to call Bill Shiflett instead. We'll get to Cooley later." She never does, though.
Yeah, Cooley never took the stand. He never said Joey had confessed to him. He never connected up Joey to the dead dogs like Colson promised the judge he would do. And maybe that's because Ellis did have personal knowledge of Cooley snitching on someone else, and Colson thought if it got out, it'd destroy the credibility of all her snitch witnesses. When Ellis and Cooley had hatched up the plot to try and get better deals by turning state's evidence on Joey, there was actually a third man in on the deal. When Sutton asked him about who else might be able to help and might be able to get a deal, Cooley told him a guy named Kevin Moy might also know a thing or two. And when Reese Ellis was interviewed by defense attorney Bill O'Dell, he elaborated even more on Moy's role.
Well, there was another guy that was in there for murder, too, and he was trying to kind of get in on it, too. But
do you remember who that guy is?
Yeah, Kevin Moy.
Kevin Moy, that's the name I've heard of. Okay. He and Cooley co-conspirators?
Are they? No.
Or is that, they're on different murder cases?
Yeah, but there's a whole thing. It's really weird because things I know too about the other case, now they've got somebody else locked up for the one that Moya did, which is the guy that Paul Cooley conspired to murder.
If that sounds confusing, it's because it is. But in January of 2000, Moy and Cooley were locked up together on separate charges, Moy for the murder of his roommate Roger Dale Coots, and Cooley for the attempted murder of his business partner Jonathan Swinford. Swinford had survived, though, so Cooley wanted revenge on the guy he'd tried but failed to kill, and meanwhile Moy knew that the police had him dead to rights in his murder charge, but wanted to get leverage to reduce his sentence. The solution kind of sounds like something straight out of the movie Strangers on a Train. Moy would implicate the guy Cooley had attempted to kill in the murder of Moy's roommate, sending Swinford to jail for life. A win-win arrangement, right? Cooley's victim would get locked away forever, and Moy would get a reduced charge as a cooperating accomplice.
It all sounds so childish and transparent, but it worked. Here's the article from the March 28, 2001 issue of the Rome News Tribune. Police arrested a third man Tuesday in connection with the September 2000 murder of a man whose decomposed body was found in a Rome field, officials of the Floyd County Police Department said. Investigators now say that Jonathan Swinford, 21, was the primary aggressor in the beating death of Roger Dale Coots, who was 54. Craig Kevin Moy, 24, was arrested September 28th after leading authorities to the body, which was found in a field on East 19th Street. Moy told police he killed Coots during a domestic altercation, but authorities now believe Moy may have been covering for Swinford. Investigators believe Swinford killed Coots in an argument about drugs. "We knew there was someone else involved," said David Stewart, an investigator on the case. Dallas Battle, another investigator, said Moy was afraid of Swinford, but it was information from other sources that led authorities to Swinford. Swinford has been charged with murder and possession of a firearm during commission of a crime. "Moy was willing to cover for him," said Battle. He said Swinford became a suspect about 6 weeks ago.
Luckily, in this particular case, the police eventually decided to drop the charges against Swinford, but not until they'd arrested him for the murder and labeled him as the primary aggressor on the front page of the Rome News. And at some point, though, they finally did seem to realize that Kevin Moy and Paul Cooley had played a fast one on them. It gives you a sense, though, of how enticing a lure it is for the cops when they find someone who says that they can testify against the cop's lead suspect. Often, too often, as soon as they have a witness who claims to have firsthand knowledge about how the murder happened and says that they'll be willing to testify on the stand, common sense goes out the window, and the desire to corroborate and preserve the cooperating witness becomes paramount. So much so that even should that witness later recant everything they said, the prosecutor might still put the witness on the stand. Because playing a tape-recorded statement of a witness implicating the defendant for the crime is often powerful enough that it can outweigh even testimony from that same witness, saying that he made it all up. Because, like Tammy Colson told the jury about Winfred Reese Ellis in this case, such witnesses have reason to lie on the stand, but what they told the cops, that was the truth.
Do you believe it to be the truth? And that is your call and your call only. But let me tell you something. Reese Ellis has a motive to lie to you today, and that motive is contained in that certified copy of his conviction where he was mad as the devil because a few weeks ago he was convicted of rape, and he was treated like everybody else that would be convicted of rape, and he got served time. And he is on his way to Jackson to the prison down there for the next 10 years at least. And he is mad at the state. He didn't recant before that. He was a cellmate, his cell buddy, and he told you some things in that first statement, and you heard that first statement that there is no way he could have known except for Joey telling him. He said, "Well, I read it in the transcript of the preliminary hearing. Give me a break." I can't pretend to be surprised anymore when I come across similarities between wrongful conviction cases. There's a definite pattern. There are, as exoneree Jeff Deskovich has said, red flags that are common to wrongful convictions. In today's episode, you may have caught one that we also found in Adnan's case, and that is the development and changing of witness stories depending on what the police know. And when the police get some things wrong, the witness gets it wrong. And when the police correct the information, the witness corrects it. It's often a sign of the police feeding a witness information. In this case, it is important and very notable that Cooley only had information that Sutton had. And when Sutton got it wrong, like where Joey was initially identified, Cooley also got it wrong. Not much different than in Adnan's case, when Jay got his timeline messed up because the police had an incorrect cell phone tower map, and then he later changed his statement after they corrected the map. And here's another common feature in wrongful convictions, because, as I've always said, it takes nearly everything going wrong to end up in this situation. And that is how well the accused is defended by his or her attorneys. Next time on Undisclosed.
And that wraps up episode 17 of the second season of Undisclosed. All right, listeners, probably the most important thing we got going on this week is the live recording of the Undisclosed Addendum from the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C. I want to tell you how you can watch starting at 6 p.m. on Thursday, November 17th. First, you got to register. Now, I could hit you with that big, long URL, but it probably wouldn't make much sense in audio. So instead, what I'm going to tell you to do is Google New America Undisclosed. The first link that pops up is going to be that registration link. You can put your information in there and you'll get a link to watch the Undisclosed Addendum live. That'll start up at 6 p.m. We're going to send out the Undisclosed Addendum in the traditional podcast format right after we cut it, and we anticipate getting that on the podcast waves at approximately 8 p.m. that evening. So if you want to see our pretty mugs do Undisclosed live, you can do so by registering for that link at New America and watching there, or otherwise, just wait till 8 p.m. You're going to get your regular dose of the addendum in its beautiful podcast format, as you always do, just this time it'll be at 8 p.m. instead of at 6. And now on to the credits. As always, our most special thanks go to the good folks of the Georgia Innocence Project. The board members hosted Susan and I at a very special gathering this past week in Atlanta. I had a blast. Thank you so much to the board members, especially to Professor Julie Seaman. Ma'am, you are an inspiration. Thanks for all you do for the Georgia Innocence Project. I had a great time. Hey, listeners. Yes, you, right now, listening in your headphone, talking to you. Give a little money to the Georgia Innocence Project. You can do so by visiting their website at www.georgiainnocenceproject.org. They got a header link for donations. Click on it. Send them some love. Every penny that you send counts. Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the two great podcasts, Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories, she produces Undisclosed, and she gets help from Hannah McCarthy and Brooke Giddings of the Actual Innocence Podcast. Ramiro Marquez and Patrick Cortez on the theme music, Baluki on the logo, Christy Williams and Nina Mooser on the website. Methil Telhan is the super producer that ties this all together. She also runs our social media, and you can get at us on the Facebooks, the Twitters, and the Instagrams using our handle, @UndisclosedPod. Tweet us, Facebook at us, Instagram at us, using hashtags like Undisclosed, #JusticeForJoey, or if you got a question and you want to see if it will be read at the live Undisclosed Addendum, tweet at Mr. John Cryer using the #UDAddendum. Maybe he'll read your question and maybe we'll give you an answer. Lastly and leastly, your executive producer for Undisclosed is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to seeing you next week for episode 18 of Undisclosed. Until then,